we come to understand, or rather, for years, refused to understand, until finally there was no denying it, because of what he himself had done, what he had forced himself to do to ensure the future freedom of his people, killing children, and, with them, his own soul. That was what had finally broken through her blindness. Her father had saved his people and destroyed himself. As strong as he looked, inside he was a ruin, or perhaps a funeral pyre, like the cusp. Only instead of the melted bones of Eiji, he was made up of the skeletons of babies and children, including, as he had always believed, his own child, her. This was his remorse. It choked him like weeds and rot and colonies of vermin, clogging and staining him, stagnant and fetid, so that nothing so noble as love, or, gods above, forgiveness, could ever claim space in him. He was even denied the relief of tears. Here was something else that Sarai knew better than anyone. The Godslayer was incapable of crying. The city's name was a taunt. In all these years, he had been unable to weep. When Sarai was young and cruel, she had tried to make him, ever without success. Poor Azarine. To see her curled up like that and skinned of all her armor was like seeing a heart flayed from a body, laid raw on a slab, and labeled grief. And Errol Fane, savior of weep, 3 years plaything of the goddess of despair. What label for him but shame? And so grief and shame abided in adjoining rooms, with the door shut between them, holding their pain in their arms instead of each other. Sarai watched them, waiting for her father to fall asleep, so that she might send her sentinel to him, if she dared, and know what he was hiding in his hearts as he hid his face in his great hands. She couldn't forget his look of horror when he had seen her in the doorway, but nor could she understand why he'd kept her secret. Now that he knew she was alive, what did he plan to do about it? And so here were the four who had flown to the Citadel and lived to tell the tale, though they apparently hadn't told it. Sarai watched them all, the sleeping and the sleepless. She was many other places too, but most of her focus was split between her father and the dreamer. When she was certain that Laszlo had at last subsided into dreams, and he had finally moved his arm so that she could see his face, she detached her moth from the casement and went to him. She couldn't quite bring herself to touch him, though, and hovered in the air above him. It would be different now. That much she knew. Up in the Citadel, pacing, she felt as jumpy as though she were really there in the room with him, ready to spook at his slightest movement. Through the moth's senses, she smelled his sandalwood and clean musk scent. His breathing was deep and even. She could tell that he was dreaming. His eyes moved under his lids, and his lashes, resting closed, as dense and glossy as the fur of river cats, fluttered gently. Finally, she couldn't stay out one moment more. With a feeling of surrender and anticipation and apprehension, she crossed the small distance to his brow, settled on his warm skin, and entered his world. He was waiting for her. He was right there, standing straight and expectant, as though he'd known she would come. Her breath caught. No, she thought. Not as though he'd known. As though he'd hoped. Her moth spooked from him and broke contact. He was too near. She wasn't prepared. But that single strobe of an instant caught the moment that his worry became relief. Relief. At the sight of her. It was only then, a flutter in the air above him, her heart's in her own far-off body drumming up a wild cadence, that Sarai realized she'd been braced for the worst, certain that today, finally, he must have learned proper disgust for her. But in that glimpse she had seen no sign of it. She took courage and returned to his brow. there he still was, and she beheld again the transformation from worry to relief. "I'm sorry," he said in his wood-smoke voice. He was farther away now. He hadn't moved exactly, but rather shifted the conception of space in the dream so as not to crowd her at its threshold. They weren't in any version of Weep, she saw, or in the library either. They were standing on the bank of a river, and it wasn't the tumultuous Uzumark, but a gentler stream. Not Weep, nor the Cusp, nor the Citadel were visible, but a great deal of pale rose sky, and beneath it, this broad path of smooth green water plied by birds with long, curved necks. Along the banks, leaning out as though to catch their own reflections, were rows of rough stone houses with their shutters painted blue. "I frightened you," said Laszlo. "Please stay." It was funny, the notion that he could frighten her. The muse of nightmares, tormentor of Weep, spooked from a dream by a sweet librarian.
"You only startled me," she said, self-conscious. "I'm not used to being greeted."
She didn't explain that she wasn't used to being seen, that all this was new to her, or that her heartbeats were tangling together, falling in and out of rhythm like children learning how to dance.
"I didn't want to miss you, if you came," said Laszlo. "I hoped you would."
There it was, the witchlight in his eyes, sparkling like sun on water. It does something to a person to be looked at like that, especially someone so accustomed to disgust. Sarai had a new, disconcerting awareness of herself, as though she'd never realized how many moving parts she had, all to be coordinated with some semblance of grace. It worked itself out so long as you didn't think about it. Start worrying, though, and it all goes wrong. How had she gone her entire life without noticing the awkwardness of arms? The way they just hang there from your shoulders, like links of meat in a shop window. She crossed them, artlessly, she felt, like some arm amateur taking the easy way out.
"Why?"
she asked him.
"What do you want?"
I don't want anything,"
he rushed to say. Of course, it was an unfair question. After all, it was she trespassing in his dream, not the other way around. He had more right to ask what she wanted here. Instead, he said,
"Well, I do want to know if you're all right. What happened to you up there? Were you hurt?"
Sarai blinked. Was she hurt? After what he had seen and survived, he was asking if she was all right.
"I'm fine," she said,
a bit gruff due to an unaccountable ache in her throat. Up in her room, she cradled her injured arm. No one in the Citadel even cared that she was hurt.
"You should have listened to me. I tried to warn you."
"Yes, well, I thought you were a dream. But apparently you're not." He paused, uncertain.
"You're not, are you? Though, of course, if you were and told me you weren't, how would I know?" "I'm not a dream," said Sarai.
There was bitterness in her voice.
"I'm a nightmare."
Laszlo breathed out a small, incredulous laugh.
"You're not my idea of a nightmare,"
he said, blushing a little.
"I'm glad you're real,"
he added, blushing a lot. And they stood there for a moment, facing each other. Though they weren't looking at each other, but down at the pebbled stretch of riverbank between their two pairs of feet. Laszlo saw that hers were bare, and that she was curling her toes into the pebbles and the soft mud beneath them. He had been thinking about her all day, and he had little enough to go on. But she'd clearly been a surprise to Errol Fane and Azarine, which led him to suppose that her entire life had been lived up in the Citadel. Had she ever set foot on the world? With this in mind, the sight of her bare blue toes curling into the river mud struck him with a deep poignancy. After which the sight of her bare blue ankles and slender calves struck him with a deep allure, so that he blushed and looked away.
and he thought that after all, in the midst of everything, it might be ridiculous to offer refreshment. But he didn't know what else to do. So he ventured, Would you care for some tea? Tea? Sarai noticed, for the first time, the table at the riverside. It was actually in the shallows, its feet lost in little foaming eddies that curled against the bank. There was a linen cloth on it and some covered dishes, along with a teapot and a pair of cups. A wisp of steam escaped the pot's spout, and she found that she could smell it, spicy and floral amid the earthier scents of the river. What they called tea in the Citadel was only herbs like mint and lemon balm. She had a distant memory of the taste of real tea, buried with her recollections of sugar and birthday cake. She fantasized about it sometimes. The drink itself, but this too. The ritual of it. The setting up and sitting down that seemed to her, from outside of it, the simple heart of culture. Sharing tea and conversation. And, it was always to be hoped, cake. She looked from the incongruous setup to the landscape around it, and then back to Laszlo, who'd caught a bit of his lower lip between his teeth, and was watching her, anxious. And Sarai noticed, outside the dream, that his real lip was likewise caught between his real teeth. His nervousness was palpable, and it disarmed her. She saw that he wanted to please her. "This is for me?" she asked with half a voice. "I'm sorry if I've gotten anything wrong," he said, abashed. "I've never had a guest before, and I'm not sure how to do it."
"A guest?"
Sarai said faintly. That word. When she went into dreams, she went as a trespasser, a marauder. She had never been invited before. She had never been welcome. The feeling that came over her was all new, and extravagantly nice.
"And I've never been a guest before," she confessed. "So I know no more about it than you do."
"That's a relief," said Laszlo. "We can make it up between us, however we like." He pulled out a chair for her. She moved to sit. Neither had ever performed this simple maneuver, on land, let alone in water. And it struck them at the same moment that there was room for error. Push the chair in too quickly or too slowly, or else sit too soon or too heavily, and misadventure ensues. Perhaps even an unintended baptism of the hindquarters. But they managed it all right, and Laszlo took the chair opposite. And just like that, they were two people sitting at a table, regarding each other shyly through a wisp of tea steam. Inside a dream. Within a lost city. In the shadow of an angel. At the brink of calamity. But all of that, city and angel and calamity, seemed worlds away right now. Swans swam past like elegant ships, and the village was all pastel with patches of blue shadow. The sky was the color of the blush on peaches, and insect language whirred in the sweet meadow grass. Laszlo considered the teapot. It seemed a lot to ask of his hands to steadily pour into such dainty cups as he'd conjured, so he had the tea pour itself, which task was accomplished admirably, as though by an invisible steward. Only one drop went astray, discoloring the linen cloth, which he promptly willed clean again. Imagine, he thought, having such power in life. And then it struck him as funny that it was the cleaning of a tablecloth that had given rise to this thought, and not the creation of an entire village and a river with birds on it, the hills in the distance, or the surprise they held in store. He had dreamed lucidly before, but never so lucidly as this. Ever since he came to weep, his dreams had been exceptionally vivid. He wondered, was it her influence that made this clarity possible? Or had his own attention and expectancy shifted him into this state of higher awareness? They picked up their cups. It was a relief to both of them to have something to do with their hands. Sarai tried her first sip,
and couldn't tell whether the flavour, smoke and flowers, was her own memory of tea, or if Laszlo was shaping the sensory experience within his dream. Did it work like that? "I don't know your name," he said to her. Sarai had never, in all her life, been asked her name or told it. She had never met anyone before. Everyone she knew, she had always known, except for captured ghosts, who weren't exactly keen on pleasantries. "It's Sarai," she said. "Sarai," he repeated, as though he were tasting it. "Sarai." It tasted, he thought, but did not say, like tea. Complex and fine and not too sweet. He looked at her, really looked. He wouldn't, in the world, ever look at a young woman with such directness and intensity. But it was somehow all right here, as though they had met with the tacit intent to know each other. "Will you tell me," he asked, "about yourself?" Sarai held her cup in both hands. She breathed the hot steam while cold water swirled around her feet. "What did Errol Fane tell you?" she asked, wary. Through another moth's eyes, she observed that her father was no longer sitting against the wall, but had moved to the open window of Azarine's sitting room and was leaning out, staring up at the citadel. Was he imagining her up there? And if so, what was he thinking? If he would sleep, she might be able to tell. She couldn't see it on his face, which was like a death mask, grim and lifeless with hollows for eyes. "He only said that you aren't Isagol," Laszlo relayed. He paused. "Are you her daughter?" Sarai lifted her gaze to him. "Did he say that?" Laszlo shook his head. "I guessed," he said. "Your hair." He had guessed something else, too. Hesitant, he said, "Suhaila told me that Errol Fane was Isagol's consort." Sarai said nothing, but truth was in her silence, and in her proud effort to show no pain. "Didn't he know about you?" Laszlo asked, sitting forward. "If he'd known he had a child." "He knew," Sarai said shortly. A half mile away, the man in question rubbed his eyes with infinite weariness. Yet still he didn't close them. "And now he knows I'm still alive. Did he say what he intends to do?" Laszlo shook his head. "He didn't say very much. He asked that we not tell anyone what happened up there, about you or any of it." Sarai had assumed as much. What she wanted to know was why, and what next. But Laszlo couldn't tell her that, and Errol Fane was still awake. Azarine had drifted off, finally, and Sarai landed a soft sentinel on the curve of her tear-stained cheek. She found no answers, though. Instead, she was plunged into the violence of the morning. She heard her own echoing cry of, "Go!" and felt the terror bearing down. Cleavers and meat hooks in the face of her own grandmother, Azarine's grandmother, twisted in unfamiliar hatred. It replayed itself over and over, relentless, and with one terrible difference. In the dream, Azarine's blades were as heavy as anchors, weighing down her arms as she strove to defend against the onslaught pouring from the angel's hand. She was too slow. It was all frantic, sluggish panic, and roiling, invincible foes. And the outcome was not so lucky as it had been that morning. In Azarine's dream, they all died, just as Sarai had told Laszlo they would. She grew quiet at the riverside, her attention drawn away. Laszlo, observing that the cerulean hue of her face had gone a little ashen, asked, "Are you all right?" She nodded. Too quickly. "I just watched you die," she did not say, but she had a hard time pushing the image from her mind. The warmth of his brow beneath her moth reassured her, and the sight of him across the table. Real Laszlo, dream Laszlo, alive because of her. It sank in that she was seeing a vision of the murders she had averted. And whatever shame she might have felt at Minya's tirade earlier, she didn't feel it any more. Deftly, she took control of Azarine's nightmare. She lightened the warrior's weapons and slowed the onslaught while the silk sleigh drifted out of range. Finally, she evanesced the ghosts, starting with Azarine's grandmother, infusing the dream with their sighs of release. The dead were free and the living were safe, and there was an end to the dream. Sarai had finished her tea. The pot refilled her cup. She thanked it as though it were alive, and then her gaze lingered on the covered dishes.
So,
she inquired, flashing a glance Laszlo's way.
What's under there?
Chapter 42. God or Monster? Monster or God? Laszlo had only marginally more experience with cake than Sarai did. So this was one of the things they made up between them, however they liked. It was a bit of a game. One would imagine the contents of a dish, and the other would uncover it with a small, dramatic flourish. They discovered that they could conjure splendid-looking confections, but were somewhat less successful when it came to flavor. Oh, the cakes weren't bad. They were sweet, at least. That much was easy. But it was a bland sweetness dreamed up by orphans who pressed their faces to sweet shop windows, metaphorically at least, and never had a taste.
They're all alike,
lamented Sarai, after sampling a small forkful of her latest creation. It was a marvel to behold. Three tall tiers glazed in pink with sugared petals, far too tall to have fit beneath the cover it was under. A magic trick, Laszlo had said, when it had seemed to grow with the lifting of the lid.
Everything here is a magic trick, Sarai had replied.
But their recipes could use a bit less magic and more reality. The imagination, as Laszlo had previously noted, is tethered in some measure to the known, and they were both sadly ignorant in matters of cake.
These should be good at least, said Laszlo, trying again. Suhaila made them for me, and I think I remember the flavor pretty well.
It was better. A honeyed pastry filled with pale green nuts and rose petal jelly. It wasn't as good as the real thing, but at least it had a specificity the others lacked. And though they could easily have willed their fingers clean, that seemed a sad waste of imaginary honey, and both were inclined to lick them instead.
I don't think we'd better attempt any dream banquets, said Laszlo, when the next attempt proved once more uninspiring.
If we did, I could provide Kimril soup, said Sarai.
Kimril? Asked Laszlo. What's that?
A virtuous vegetable, she said. It has no flavor to tempt one to overindulgence, but it will keep you alive.
There was a little pause as Laszlo considered the practicalities of life in the Citadel. He was reluctant to abandon this sweet diversion, and the lightness it had brought to his guest. But he couldn't sit here with this vision of her and not wonder about the real her, whom he'd glimpsed so briefly and under such terrible circumstances.
Has it kept you alive? He inquired.
It has, she said. You might say it's a staple. The Citadel gardens lack variety.
I saw fruit trees, Laszlo said.
Yes, we have plums, thank Gardner. Sarai smiled.
In the Citadel, when it came to food, they had been known to praise Gardner, as others might praise God. They owed an even greater debt to Wraith for that bundle of Kimril tubers that had made all the difference. Such were the deities in the Citadel of dead gods, an obscure human gardener and an antisocial bird. And, of course, none of it would have mattered without Sparrow's and Feral's gifts to nurture and water what little they had. How unassailable the Citadel looked from below, she thought, and yet how tenuous their life was in it. Laszlo had not missed her plural pronoun.
We?
He asked casually, as though it weren't a monumental question. Are you alone up there? Are there others like you?
Evasive, Sarai turned her attention to the river.
Right where she looked, a fish leapt up, rainbow iridescence shimmering on its scales. It splashed back down and sank out of sight. Did it make any difference, she wondered, if Laszlo and Errol Fane found out there were more Godspawn alive in the Citadel? The rule was broken. There was evidence of life. Did it matter how much life? It seemed to her that it did. And anyway, it felt like betrayal to give the others away. So she said,
"The ghosts."
"Ghosts eat plums." Having determined to lie, she did so baldly.
"Voraciously."
Laszlo let it pass. He wanted to know about the ghosts, of course, and why they were armed with kitchen tools, viciously attacking their own kin. But he started with a slightly easier question, and asked simply how they came to be there.
"I suppose everyone has to be somewhere," Sarai said evasively.
Laszlo agreed, thoughtful.
"Though some have more control over the where than others."
He didn't mean the ghosts now. He cocked his head a little and looked intently at Sarai. She felt his question forming. She didn't know what words he would use, but the gist of it boiled down to why. Why are you up there? Why are you trapped? Why is this your life? Why everything about you? And she wanted to tell him, but she felt her own return question burgeoning within her. It felt a little like the burgeoning of moths at darkfall, but it was something much more dangerous than moths. It was hope. It was, "Can you help me? Can you save me? Can you save us?" When she'd gone down to weep to meet the Godslayer's guests, she'd had no scope to imagine him. A friend? An ally? A dreamer in whose mind the best version of the world grew like seed stock. If only it could be transplanted into reality, she thought. But it couldn't. It couldn't. Who knew better how poisonous the soil was in Weep than she who had been poisoning it for 10 long years? So instead she cut off his almost question and asked,
"Speaking of where, what is this place?"
Laszlo didn't press her. He had patience for mysteries. All these years, though, the mysteries of Weep had never had the urgency of this one. This was life or death. It had almost been his death. But he had to earn her trust. He didn't know how to do that, and so once again sought refuge in stories.
"Ah, well, I'm glad you asked. This is a village called Zeltsin. Or at least this is how I imagine a village called Zeltsin might look. It's an ordinary place. Pretty, if unexceptional. But it does have one distinction."
His eyes sparkled. Sarai found herself curious. She looked around her, wondering what that distinction might be. Earlier, while he was trying to fall asleep, Laszlo's first thought was to make an elegant sort of parlor to receive her in if she came. It seemed the proper way to go about things, if a bit dull. For some reason, then, Calixte's voice had come into his head.
"Beautiful and full of monsters," she'd said. "All the best stories are."
And she was right.
"Any guesses?"
he asked Sarai. She shook her head. Her eyes had a bit of a sparkle, too.
"Well, I might as well tell you," said Laszlo, enjoying himself. "There's a mine shaft over there that's an entrance to the underworld."
"The underworld?"
Sarai repeated, craning her neck in the direction he pointed.
"Yes, but that's not the distinction."
She narrowed her eyes.
"Then what is?"
"I could also tell you that the children here are born with teeth and gnaw on bird bones in their cradles."
She winced.
"That's horrible."
"But that's not the distinction either."
Won't you tell me?
She asked, growing impatient. Laszlo shook his head. He was smiling. This was fun.
It's quiet, don't you think?
He asked, faintly teasing.
I wonder where everyone's gone.
It was quiet. The insects had ceased their whirring. There was only the sound of the river now. Behind the village, sweet meadows climbed toward a ridge of hills that looked, from a distance, to be covered in dark fur. Hills that seemed, Sarai thought, to be holding their breath. She sensed it, a preternatural stillness, and held hers too. And then, the hills exhaled, and so did she.
Oh,
she breathed.
Is it?
The Mahalath, said Laszlo. The 50-year mist that made gods or monsters. It was coming. It was fog, tongues of white vapor extruding between the knuckles of the fur-dark hills. But it moved like a living thing, with a curious, hunting intelligence. At once light and dense, there was something lithe about it, almost serpentine. Unlike fog, it didn't merely drift and settle, tumbling downward, heavier than the air. Here and there, tendrils of its curling white churn seemed to rise up and peer about, before collapsing again into the tidal flow, like whitecaps sucked back into the surf. It was pouring downward, pouring itself downward, in a glorious, relentless glissade over the meadow slopes, on a straight path for the village.
Did you ever play make-believe?
Laszlo asked Sarai. She gave a laugh.
Not like this.
She was frightened and exhilarated.
Shall we flee? He asked. Or stay and take our chances?
The tea table had vanished, and the chairs and dishes too. Without noticing the transition, the pair of them were standing knee-deep in the river, watching the Mahalath swallow the farthest houses of the village. Sarai had to remind herself that none of it was real. It was a game within a dream. But what were the rules?
Will it change us? She asked. Or do we change ourselves?
I don't know, said Laszlo, to whom this was also new.
I think we could choose what we want to become. Or we could choose to let the dream choose, if that makes sense.
It did. They could exert control or relinquish it to their own unconscious minds. Either way, it wasn't a mist remaking them, but themselves. God or monster, monster or God. Sarai had an ugly thought.
What if you're already a monster?
She asked in a whisper. Laszlo looked over at her, and the witchlight in his eyes said that she was nothing of the sort.
Anything can happen, he said. That's the whole point.
The mist poured forth. It swallowed the drifting swans one by one.
Stay or go?
Laszlo asked. Sarai faced the Mahalath. She let it come. And as its first tendrils wrapped around her like arms, she reached for Laszlo's hand and held it tight. Chapter 43. A singularly unhorrible demon. Inside a mist, inside a dream, a young man and woman were remade. But first, they were unmade, their edges fading like the evanescent white bird, Wraith, as it phased through the skin of the sky. All sense of physical reality slipped away, except for one. Their hands, joined together, remained as real as bone and sinew. There was no world anymore, no riverbank or water, nothing beneath their feet. And anyway, no feet. There was only that one point of contact, and even as they let go of themselves, Laszlo and Sarai held on to each other. And when the mist passed on its way, and the remade swans lauded their magnificence over the humble green river, they turned to each other,
fingers interlaced, and looked, and looked, and looked. Eyes wide and shining, eyes unchanged. His were still grey, hers were still blue, and her lashes were still honey red, and his as glossy black as the pelts of river cats. His hair was still dark, and hers was still cinnamon, and his nose was the victim of velvet-bound fairy tales, and her mouth was damson lush. They were both in every way unchanged, save one. Sarai's skin was brown, and Laszlo's was blue. They looked and looked and looked at each other, and they looked at their joined hands, the brown and blue pattern of their fingers reversed, and they looked at the surface of the water, which hadn't been a mirror before, but was now because they willed it so, and they gazed at themselves in it, side by side and hand in hand, and they beheld neither gods nor monsters. They were so nearly unchanged, and yet that one thing, the color of their skin, would, in the real world, change everything. Sarai looked at the rich earthen color of her arms, and she knew, though it was hidden, that she bore an Illilith on her belly like a human girl. She wondered what the pattern was, and wished that she could take a peek. The other hand, the one joined with Laszlo's, she gently withdrew. There seemed no further pretext for holding it, though it had been rather nice while it lasted. She looked at him. Blue. "Did you choose this?" she asked. Laszlo shook his head. "I left it to the Mahalath," he said. "And it did this?" She wondered why. Her own change was easier to understand. Here was her humanity externalized, and all her longing for freedom, from disgust, from the confines of her metal cage. But why should he come to this? Maybe, she thought, it wasn't longing but fear, and this was his idea of a monster. "Well, I wonder what gift it has given you," she said. "Gift? You mean magic? Do you think I have one?" "All Godspawn have gifts."
"Godspawn?"
"That's what they call us." "Us." Another collective pronoun. It glimmered between them briefly, but Laszlo didn't call attention this time.
"Spawn, though," he said, grimacing. "It doesn't suit. That's the offspring of fish or demons."
"The intent, I believe, is the latter."
"Well, you're a singularly unhorrible demon, if I may say so."
"Thank you,"
Sarai said with play sincerity, laying a modest hand across her breast.
"That's the nicest thing anyone has ever said to me."
"Well, I have at least 100 nicer things to say, and am only prevented by embarrassment."
His mention of embarrassment magically conjured embarrassment. In her reflection, Sarai saw the way her brown cheeks went crimson instead of lavender, while Laszlo beheld the reverse in his own.
"So, gifts," he said, recovering,
though Sarai wouldn't have minded dwelling for a moment on his 100 nicer things.
"And yours is... going into dreams?"
She nodded. She saw no need to explain the mechanics of it. Ruby's long-ago commiseration flashed through her mind.
"Who would ever want to kiss a girl who eats moths?"
The thought of kissing stirred a fluttering in her belly that was something like it might feel if her moths really did live inside of her. Wings, delicate and tickling.
"So how do I know what it is, this gift?" Laszlo asked. "How does one find out?"
"It's always different," she told him. "Sometimes it's spontaneous and obvious, and other times it has to be teased out. When the Mazarthim were alive, it was Koriko, the goddess of secrets, who did the teasing out. Or so I'm told. I must have known her, but I can't remember."
The question, "Told by whom?" was so palpable between them that, though Laszlo didn't ask it, except perhaps with his eyebrows,
Sarai nevertheless answered.
By the ghosts, she said,
which happened in this case to be the truth.
Koriko, said Laszlo.
He thought back on the mural, but he'd been so fixed on Izogol that the other goddesses were a blur. Suhela had mentioned Letha, but not the other one.
I haven't heard anything about her. No, you wouldn't. She was the goddess of secrets, and her best-kept secret was herself. No one ever knew what her gift even was.
Another mystery, said Laszlo. And they talked of gods and gifts, walking by the river. Sarai kicked at the surface, and watched the flying droplets shiver ephemeral rainbows. They pointed to the swans, which had been identical before, but now were strange. One fanged and made of agates and moss, another seeming dipped in gold. One had even become a sphytogore. It submerged and vanished beneath the opaque green water. Sarai told Laszlo some of the better gifts she knew from Great Ellen, and slipped in among them a girl who could make things grow, and a boy who could bring rain. His own gift, if the Mahalath had given him one, remained a mystery.
But what about you?
He asked her, pausing to pluck a flower that he had just willed to grow. It was an exotic bloom he'd seen in a shop window, and he would have been abashed to know it was called a passion flower. He offered it to Sarai.
If you were human, you'd have to give up your gift, wouldn't you?
He couldn't know the curse that her gift was, or what the use of it had done to her and to weep.
I suppose so, she said,
sniffing the flower, which smelled of rain.
But then you couldn't be here with me.
It was true. If she were human, Sarai couldn't be in Laszlo's dream with him. But she could be in his room with him. A heat flared through her, and it wasn't shame or even embarrassment. It was a kind of longing, but not heart's longing. It was skin's longing, to be touched. It was limbs' longing, to entwine. It was centered in her belly, where her new Illilith was, and she brushed her fingers over it again and shivered. Up in the citadel, pacing, her true body shivered in kind.
It's a sacrifice I would be willing to make, she said.
Laszlo couldn't fathom it, that a goddess would be willing to give up her magic. It wasn't just the magic, either. He thought she would be beautiful in any color, but he found he missed the true exquisite hue of her.
You wouldn't really want to change, though, would you?
He persisted. If this were real, and you had the choice.
Wouldn't she?
Why else had her unconscious, her inner Mahalath, chosen this transformation?
If it meant having a life, yes, I would.
He was puzzled.
But you're alive already.
He felt a sudden stab of fear.
You are, aren't you? You're not a ghost like the ones. I'm not a ghost, said Sarai, to his great relief. But I am Godspawn. And you must see that there's a difference between being alive and having a life.
Laszlo did see that. At least, he thought he saw. He thought that what she meant was in some way comparable to being a foundling at Zemanin Abbey. Alive, but not living a life. And because he had found his way from one to the other, and had even seen his dream come true, he felt a certain qualification on the subject. But he was missing a crucial piece of the puzzle. A crucial, bloody piece of the puzzle. Reasonably and warmly, he sympathized.
It can't be much of a life trapped up there. But now that we know about you, we can get you out. Get me out? What? Down to weep?
There was a twist of incredulous amusement in Sarai's voice, and while she spoke, she reverted to her true color, her skin flushing back to blue.
So much for human, she thought.
The hard truth would brook no make-believe. As though her reversion had triggered an end to the fantasy, Laszlo reverted too, and was himself again. Sarai was almost sorry. When he had looked like that, She could almost have believed a connection between them. Had she really wondered, wistfully, a short time earlier, if this dreamer could help her, could save her? He had no clue.
"You do understand, don't you?"
she said with undue harshness.
"That they would kill me on sight."
"Who would?"
"Anyone would."
"No." He shook his head, unwilling to believe it. "They're good people. It will be a surprise, yes. But they couldn't hate you just because of what your parents were." Sarai stopped walking.
"You think good people can't hate?" she asked. "You think good people don't kill?"
Her breathing hitched, and she realized she'd crushed Laszlo's flower in her hand. She dropped the petals into the water.
"Good people do all the things bad people do, Laszlo. It's just that when they do them, they call it justice."
She paused. Her voice grew heavy.
"When they slaughter 30 babies in their cradles, they call it necessary."
Laszlo stared at her. He shook his head in disbelief.
"That shock you saw on Errol Fane's face," she went on. "It wasn't because he didn't know he had a child."
She took a breath.
"It was because he thought he killed me 15 years ago.
Her voice broke at the end. She swallowed hard. She felt, suddenly, as though her entire head were filled with tears, and if she didn't shed some of them, it would explode.
"When he killed all the Godspawn, Laszlo,"
she added, and wept. Not in the dream, not where Laszlo could see, but up in her room, hidden away, tears sheeted down her cheeks, the way the monsoon rains sheeted down the smooth contours of the citadel in summer, flooding in through all the open doors, a rolling deluge of rain across the slick floors, and nothing to do but wait for it to stop. Errol Fane had known that one of the babies in the nursery was his, but he didn't know which one. He had seen Isigold's belly swell with his child, of course, but after she was delivered of it, she had never mentioned it again. He'd asked. She'd shrugged. She'd done her duty. It was the nursery's problem now. She hadn't even known if it was a boy or a girl. It was nothing to her. And when he had walked, drenched in God's blood, into the nursery, and looked about him at the squalling blue infants and toddlers, he had feared that he would see and know. "There, that one is mine." If he had seen Sarai, cinnamon-haired like her mother, he would have known her in an instant. But he hadn't, because she wasn't there. But he hadn't known that. For all he knew, her hair was dark like his own, like all the rest of the babies. They made a blur of blue and blood and screams. All innocent. All anathema. All dead. Laszlo's eyes were dry, but wide and unblinking. Babies. His mind rejected it, even as, under the surface, puzzle pieces were snapping together. All the dread and the shame he'd seen in Errol Fane. Everything about the meeting with the Zaedin, and the way Muldiger had laid her hands on her stomach. Suhaila, too. It was a maternal gesture. How stupid he'd been not to see it. But then how could he, when he'd spent his life among old men? All the things that hadn't quite made sense now shifted just enough. And it was like tilting the angle of the sun, so that instead of glancing off a window pane and blinding you, it passed through it to illuminate all that was within. He knew Sarai was telling the truth. A great man and also a good one. Is that what he had thought? But the man who had slain gods had also slain their babies, and Laszlo understood now what it was he'd feared to find in the citadel. "Some of us know better than others the state it was left in," he had said. not the skeletons of gods, but infants. Laszlo hunched over, feeling ill. He pressed a palm hard to his forehead. The village and the monster swans vanished. The river was no more. It all blinked out, and Laszlo and Sarai found themselves in his little room, the Godslayer's little room. Laszlo's sleeping body wasn't stretched out on the bed. This was one more dream setting. In reality, he was sleeping in the room, and in the dream, he was standing in it. In reality, a moth perched on his brow. In the dream, the Muse of Nightmares stood beside him. The Muse of Nightmares, Sarai thought. As much as ever. She had, after all, brought nightmare to this dreamer to whom she had come seeking refuge. In his sleep, he murmured, "No." His eyes and fists were squeezed tight shut. His breathing was quick, and so was his pulse. All the hallmarks of nightmare. How well Sarai knew them. All she'd done was tell the truth. She hadn't even shown it to him. Knife shine and spreading blood, and all the small blue bodies. Nothing would induce her to drag that festering memory into this beautiful mind.
"I'm sorry," she said.
Up in the citadel, she sobbed. She could never be free of the fester. Her own mind would always be an open grave.
"Why are you sorry?"
Laszlo asked her. There was sweetness in his voice, but the brightness had left it. It had gone dull somehow, like an old coin.
"You're the last person who should be sorry. He's supposed to be a hero," he said. "He let me believe it. But what kind of hero could do that?"
In Windfall, the hero in question was lying stretched out on the floor. He was as still as a sleeper, but his eyes were open in the dark. And Sarai thought again how he was as much a ruin as he was a man. He was, she thought, like a cursed temple, still beautiful to look at, the shell of something sacred, but benighted within, and none but ghosts could ever cross the threshold.
"What kind of hero?"
Laszlo had asked. What kind, indeed? Sarai had never let herself rise to his defense. It was unthinkable, as though the bodies themselves were a barrier between her and forgiveness. Nevertheless, and not quite knowing what she was going to say, she told Laszlo, speaking softly,
"For 3 years, Isagol made him love her. That is, she didn't inspire love. She didn't strive to be worthy of it. She just reached into his mind, or his heart's, or his soul, and played the note that would make him love her against everything that was in him. She was a very dark thing."
She shuddered to think how she herself had come from the body of this very dark thing.
"She didn't take away his conflicting emotions, although she could have. She didn't make him not hate her. She left his hate there, right beside the love. She thought it was funny, and it wasn't. It wasn't dislike beside lust, or some trivial pale versions of hate and love. You see, it was hate."
She put everything she knew of hate into her voice. And not her own hate, but Errol Fane's and the rest of the victims of the Mazathim.
"It was the hate of the used and tormented, who are the children of the used and tormented, and whose own children will be used and tormented. And it was love,"
she went on. And she put that into her voice, too, as well as she was able. "Love that sets forth the soul like springtime and ripens it like summer. Love as rarely exists in reality, as if a master alchemist has taken it and distilled out all the impurities, every petty disenchantment, every unworthy thought, into a perfect elixir, sweet and deep and all-consuming.
He loved her," so much, she whispered. It was all a lie. It was a violation. But it didn't matter, did it? Because when Isagol made you feel something, it became real. He hated her. And he loved her. And he killed her.
She sank onto the edge of Laszlo's bed and let her gaze roam over the familiar walls. Memories can be trapped in a room. And this one still held all the years that she'd come in this window, full of righteous malice. Laszlo sank down beside her.
Hate won, she said. Isagol left it there for her amusement, and for 3 years he fought a war within himself. The only way he could win was for his hate to surpass that vile, false, perfect love. And it did.
Her jaw clenched. She darted a glance at Laszlo. This story wasn't hers to tell, but she thought he needed to know.
After Scathis brought Azarine up to the Citadel.
Laszlo knew a little of the story already.
They got her later,
Suhaila had said. Sarai knew all of it. She alone knew of the tarnished silver band that Azarine put on her finger every night and took off first thing every morning. Theirs wasn't the only love story ended by the gods, but it was the only one that ended the gods. Errol Fane had been gone for more than 2 years by the time Scathis took Azarine, and she might have been the first girl in Weep who was glad to mount the monster Rasalas and fly up to her own enslavement. She would know, at least, if her husband was still alive. He was. And Azarine had learned how you can be glad and devastated at the same time. She heard his laugh before she saw his face. Errol Fane's laugh, in that place, as alive as she had ever heard it. And she broke away from her guard to run toward it, skidding around a corner of the sleek metal corridor to the sight of him gazing at Isagol the Terrible with love. She knew it for what it was. He had looked at her like that, too. It wasn't feigned, but true. And so, after more than 2 years of wondering what had become of him, Azarine found out. In addition to the misery of serving the gods' purpose, it was her fate to watch her husband love the goddess of despair. And Errol Fane, it was his fate to see his bride led down the sinister corridor, door after door of little rooms with nothing in them but beds. And finally, Isagol's calculus failed. Love was no match for what burned in Errol Fane when he heard Azarine's first screams.
Hate was his triumph,
Sarai told Laszlo.
It was who he became to save his wife and all his people. So much blood on his hands, so much hate in his hearts. The gods had created their own undoing.
She sat there for a moment, mute, and felt an emptiness within her where for years her own sustaining hate had been. There was only a terrible sadness now.
And after they were slain, and all their slaves were freed, she said heavily, there was still the nursery, and a future full of terrible, unguessable magic.
The tears that had, until now, flowed only down Sarai's real cheeks, slipped down her dream ones, too. Laszlo reached for her hands and held them in both of his own.
It's a violence that can never be forgiven, she said,
her voice husky with emotion.
Some things are too terrible to forgive. But I think I can understand what they felt that day, and what they faced. What were they to do with children who would grow into a new generation of tormentors?
Laszlo reeled with the horror of it all, and with the incredible feeling that, after all, his own youth had been merciful.
But if they'd been embraced instead, and raised with love,
he said.